From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 165. This week is a special throwback to the early days, and who better to listen to again than podcast favourite Chef Taffy Elrod. I found myself stuck with either a very long episode or a double that would be split over too long a period, so I made the decision to repeat an episode for the first time. Things are pretty busy and stressful here with a big move back to the UK and all that entails, so I scrolled right back to the start and it took all of 10 seconds to know just who to share with you again. It's been a really stressful and busy year for Taffy too, so I haven't been able to record with her for a long time and I know you all miss her very much. Maybe you're new to the podcast and haven't met her yet. Either way, you're in for a treat because she is most definitely extraordinary as well as very wonderful. I'll link to all her episodes in the show notes, which you can find at ketowomanpodcast.com/165 or click on the link in the description wherever you're listening to this episode. She hangs out a lot on Instagram, so go follow her there to see all the delicious things she makes, at Keto Cooking School. If you don't know Taffy already, this is a little bit about her. Taffy Elrod is a professional chef, cooking instructor, recipe developer, food writer, and former restaurant owner with over 20 years' experience in the food industry. Born into a family of artists and cooks in Ann Arbor, Michigan, she learned early on that food was a powerful medium for creation and change. She is passionate about empowering others to cook and enjoy the food that matters most to them. Taffy resides in New York's Hudson Valley, where she cooks and develops recipes with her husband, Pizza Man, and their rescue cat, Kit Kat. I really enjoyed listening to this again after so long. This was way back when Brandon used to do my editing. Gosh, that feels so long ago now. Always a treat for me to listen to Taffy. I hope you enjoy it as much and have something nice to look forward to for Christmas or whatever festive day you celebrate. Maybe like my dad who lives in Thailand, it's more about New Year's instead. It's going to be strange for most of us this year, isn't it? Mine will be much the same. Just me and the dogs and cats and a day where I get to do whatever I feel like doing. Keto Women actually falls on Christmas Day this year, so I will be beaming out to you across the web waves with my keto buddies for a very random and rambly chat. Take good care of yourselves, stay safe, and I hope you get to have some good times over the holidays. Welcome back to the Keto Women podcast, Tiffany. It's lovely to see you again. How are you?
I'm wonderful, Daisy. Thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Well, I thought as this show is the Christmas show, the one just before Christmas, we'd talk a little bit about Christmas traditions that we're familiar with. I thought that would be a nice twist, and there might even be the odd recipe.
Perhaps so. I'm excited to talk about it and all the fun and delightful traditions that are still fully available to be keto-fied.
Yes, that's the thing, isn't it? It's an exciting challenge to try and keto-fy some of your favorites.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess some of them are probably out. They're probably right out. But there's a lot that are still very much available and that can be enjoyed in new ways, and then maybe some new traditions in the making too.
Yeah, and I think quite often actually you come to enjoy the keto-fied one even more, even if it is quite different from what you were familiar with before.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I love about this way of life is that I found that a lot of the holiday traditions and special foods that I cook, somehow I find myself enjoying them more, becoming creative with them in new ways, and that oftentimes they become more delicious, actually.
Yeah, all the better for being keto.
Yeah, it's interesting. But as I mentioned before, as a chef, I really love this way of cooking. It really resonates with me.
Absolutely.
And a lot of great stuff that maybe was pushed out that can be brought back in. You know, there's so many things like eggnog. Hey, who knew that eggnog would end up being such a perfect ketogenic holiday treat?
Absolutely. And something I keep meaning to make, actually, which has been a tradition of mine at Christmas, a little tipple, the Bailey's Irish whiskey and cream. And that's actually super easy, isn't it, to keto-fy? So yeah. I must do it because it's something I've always liked. Some of that, it's sickly and it's rich, but over some ice. I've always rather liked it at Christmas. So I'm determined to try that this year.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, now we can use our heavy cream with impunity and enjoy those things the way they're meant to be enjoyed, because the holiday is, in theory, a feasting day, right? So, you know, maybe you've been fasting, maybe you haven't, maybe you follow some sort of religious fast before the holiday, but that day, that feeling of really allowing yourself to feast and enjoy and appreciate what the holiday is about, I feel like it, again, it sort of releases some of that back into the spirit of the season.
Absolutely. And goes well with the format that quite a few people who are keto get into, the whole feast and fast process that they go through. So it really does resonate well with that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So why don't you kick us off and talk about the first tradition?
Well, since I just talked about feasting, here where I am in New York State, there is a large Italian-American population. I have some Italian heritage as well in my family. And in this area, they love their Feast of the Seven Fishes, or the Vigil, but everyone here seems to call it the Feast of the Seven Fishes. And what's funny about it, it's called the Feast of the Seven Fishes, but Christmas Eve is traditionally considered a fasting day in traditional Catholic and some other Christian traditions. So it's seafood because it's a fasting day in which there's no meat. But it's become this enormous, bountiful, amazing feast of every seafood you can imagine. Even though it's called the Feast of the Seven Fishes, some people do seven different types of seafood in their meal. Some people do seven different courses of seafood. Some people do, they just get every seafood they can get, and they cook for 3 days straight, and they have so much seafood. And we were lucky enough to be invited to a friend's last year to partake without even having to cook, which was nice. And I mean, there was boy, oh boy, there was lobster bisque, there was stuffed oysters, there was mushroom stuffed with clam, seared scallops. I mean, the list just goes on and on. I honestly can't recount everything. There was definitely something with caviar, and there was raw clams, and there were steamed clams. And like I said, you know, of course, a lot of folks here do calamari, or they'll make a seafood stew, cioppino, something like that, whatever it is. You know, there's always some shellfish. There's always usually some sort of white fish or, you know, salmon, something like that involved. Here, it's a tradition that people really, you know, that relate to. It goes back. Their grandparents did it for them. They do it for their grandchildren. And it has such a excitement and a joy to it. I really love that. It really is this, you know, it's before midnight on Christmas Eve, especially if, you know, if you're going to midnight mass, before midnight mass. And there's so much family and excitement and joy involved in it. And I love that it's a tradition that preserves that, that, you know, really is about bringing everyone together and really being involved together, and whether you're shucking clams together or whatever it may be.
It sounds absolutely amazing, and my idea of heaven, really, truly delicious. I would love to participate in that feast. So it's interesting that you said, though, so that's actually classified as a fasting day purely because you're fasting from meat, but you still have this huge feast of
right
all things fish and seafood.
It's sort of American tradition, probably. That's probably where the American in the Italian American comes in, having so much, such a bounty. There are other fasting traditions where I'm not expert in this, but I've heard of it, like for instance, in Ukrainian tradition where Orthodox, I believe, that they have what is essentially a vegan meal. There's no meat, there's no dairy, there's no cheese or anything. So, you know, the different people have a different sense of what it means to fast, but obviously for some that means no meat.
I have to be honest that the vegan equivalent does not sound as delicious.
Well, I've seen some pretty amazing, intricate dishes that are beautiful, but it sounds more like a fast. It doesn't sound quite as luxurious as all that wonderful seafood.
That's right.
And maybe a little champagne.
Yeah, but that would improve it. Yeah. I like the fact that you talk about that a big part of the tradition is the whole family becoming involved and really getting involved in the whole preparation and cooking process. That sounds really nice. It reminds me of Christmas Day in my family household, where everyone sort of takes a bit of a role with cooking the Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
It's a fun thing to get everyone involved in, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I think whatever the tradition is, it always is more enjoyable and more rich when what it really is doing is bringing people together to have a way to interact with one another and enjoy the time together. Obviously, seafood is good for that because it's interactive. Like I said, you might be shucking clams, or it's one of the few foods that Americans still bring home whole, like animal foods, whole or even alive, that they actually prepare from beginning to end. And it's that very sensual involvement with the food that I think is very meaningful. And then again, with whoever that may be, your family, your friends, like the friends who invited us last year, that you are involved together and you're enjoying it together. And I think that is a true feast, whatever it may be, whatever this, you know, the holiday or the occasion is. We want to have that conviviality and that feeling that we're brought together by something and, you know, can really celebrate with one another.
One of the things I like about seafood when it comes to the table, still with things that it's that whole unwrapping thing, isn't it? And you get,
right,
you know, your hands get dirty and you've got those dipping bowls in the middle to clean your fingers off with, but shucking the prawns and the digging things out of shells. And it's all very, I don't know, there's something quite sort of primal and exciting and, I don't know, sort of reminds you of childhood in a way, just sort of making a mess.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's, there's a satisfaction there from being involved and getting your hands a little dirty and really feeling like you're getting at the meat of something. I think really is primal, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, really speaks to our humanity and makes us feel connected in a different way. I mean, that's pure, really my opinion, but I do think there really is something to that. And like I said, so I think for that to be involved in your holiday fair, you know, really does bring out that excitement and that fun in people.
That's a great idea. I'd love to bring that tradition in. Yeah, this seven fishes feast on Christmas Eve. Yeah, I'm definitely up for that.
Yeah, right. And it's on Christmas Eve too. So, you know, you're leading into the holiday and you know, it's sort of a build up. It's not even the main event. So you just, although it kind of is the main event for some people, I think, but you know, like I said, so it's really a great way to really start that holiday excitement.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good one. Let's have another one.
Well, I have been lucky enough to spend the holidays with a few different people, especially once a little different from the Midwest to move into the East Coast when I came to New York. And another holiday tradition that I've taken part of that I think is really great, brilliant for keto is with a friend of mine whose family's from Jamaica, and her mother made her traditional goat curry or curried goat. You know, slow, long cooked braise of goat meat, which I guess not all Americans eat or have eaten. That was probably the first time I'd ever had goat, maybe the first or second time. I was surprised that it was more tender and, you know, sort of a gentler meat than I expected. I think I was expecting something gamier. You know, and of course, braising anything, and when you curry something, you know, that amazing flavor and that richness of a long, slow cooking. And she made a wonderful meal. She made homemade eggnog, which was the best that I've ever had. I'm not a huge eggnog fan, but that that was good stuff. Mm-hmm. And the hibiscus or sorrel punch. This, you know, the hibiscus, the red hibiscus flower that's made with, generally with some rum, I do believe.
That sounds interesting. So presumably it adds a flavor note to it, does it, the hibiscus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit tangy. And, of course, usually then there's some spices involved as well. I don't have a recipe myself, but, you know, there's some spices there. And everybody, I think, sort of has their own, you know, their own brew, their own blend. It's light. It's refreshing. It's like a punch. You know, it's punchy. It's a beautiful red color. And it's, I like that. It's got that little tanginess to it. They serve it in the city at a lot of different events and special occasions, iced in the summertime. If you ever go to the Labor Day parade, the West Indian Day parade, it's everywhere. And again, very festive. So between the sorrel punch and the eggnog, you're good to go for the holidays.
Yeah, you need the curried goat to soak it all up. That hibiscus punch sounds like it would go quite nicely, actually, with the curried goat.
Yeah, I certainly thought so. You know, only, and this is me as a bystander, you know, as someone just in being luxurious enough to just enjoy it. You know, definitely.
But that's the thing, isn't it? In the name, I know you get looked at with daggers if you say goat curry. It's not goat curry. It has to be curried goat, isn't it? Is that right?
I think so. Again, maybe I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's, you know, it's better to say curried goat, preferable.
So. It's very delicious. I've had it once or twice. And yeah, I'm a real fan. It's spicy and it has heat, but it's not the kind of heat that blows the roof of your mouth away, is it?
Right?
It's just that lovely, warming, spicy heat.
Yeah, it's a very, very much a comfort food, I would say. But that's the other thing that I find intriguing and that's so interesting is the ways in which people take this same holiday and express it through their locality, what's available to them, how they approach it. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm from Michigan originally, and I have German in my background and some, you know, some Northern European. And of course, that's a very different way because it's cold. It's the cold, dark time of the year, right? And so things tend to be about very hearty food, not much spices at all, you know, and very rib sticking kind of fare. And then a lot of, how can I say, you know, like a lot of comfort food, a lot of very much just this, and sometimes, you know, maybe it's even a little bland by certain people's standards, I'm not sure. But, you know, I grew up with a lot of cabbage and those kind of hardier vegetables. My grandmother used to make turnips and rutabaga and parsnip and, you know, lots of root vegetables and things like that, all during the winter and also at the holidays.
And what's the typical standard American Christmas day, if you like? Certainly in the UK, it's all about the turkey, but potentially it's a bit different for you because you've had the turkey with Thanksgiving. So what does Christmas Day look like?
Well, yeah, that's true. Some people do turkey again, you know, the turkey on Thanksgiving Day too. I really think Christmas is very personal. Everyone, I don't think there's a standard meal. And I think, you know, and I probably don't even know all the Christmas traditions going on out there, but whatever your background is, I think some people, I know someone who gets together and the whole family makes like these Italian dumplings together. You know, that's their big Christmas thing. And of course, some people do roast beef or a tenderloin, turkey. There's, you know, goose. My father's girlfriend is from Hungary. They do a roast goose. I don't know. Maybe someone will tell us, you know, that we're wrong. Somebody will set right in. I don't know if, as I can say, there is one traditional American Christmas Day, you know, feast or food. There's so many different traditions that people bring to it.
There is quite a typical general standard expected Christmas dinner in the UK. But what's coming across from what you're saying is that it's very much steeped in your family and community's tradition. So like you were saying, it is very different depending on your family and the cultural influences, also the community in which you live and that you're used to. So it is a very traditional thing that comes to be in your family over generations that is influenced by your heritage, but comes to mean something different depending who you are and who you spend time with. And I like that.
That's how I see it, you know, looking at it, asking myself, did I ever ask myself before what's really Christmas tradition? Probably not to this extent because, you know, I've cooked some different meals for different folks and, you know, all sorts of things, even from like Maltese curries to, you know, vegan meals. And I really do think it's your community, your family, you know, your background. It's what's close to your heart. And, you know, my grandmother used to make baked spaghetti on Christmas Eve. And I think that was sort of a nod. Yeah. So, you know, my maternal grandmother was German, but my maternal grandfather was Italian. And I think that was sort of a nod to his background, you know, a la the Midwest. So we would have baked spaghetti for Christmas Eve. We, you know, it was every year. We loved it. It was our tradition. Apropos of anybody else's tradition, I couldn't say, you know, but that was our tradition. And then we had a more sort of traditional meal on Christmas Day. But by traditional, I mean traditional, but it was vegetarian. So again, you know, sometimes I think maybe I'm just out of the loop on what other people were having on Christmas Day because we had such a funny, I have an unusual background. My dad's folks are from down south, but I didn't get to spend that time with them. I didn't do the holidays with them. So I can't even say what they, you know, what their holiday traditions really were, beyond the obvious things of, you know, yams and things like that.
So yours had a vegetarian twist. What kind of vegetarian Christmas traditions did you have on Christmas Day then?
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's not much worth mentioning when it comes to keto because it was, of course, very carby. But my grandmother, who was the spearhead of the vegetarian, she would make sort of a traditional meal just without the meat. So she made dressing and mashed potatoes and, you know, there was always a relish tray. So at least that was, we could still have a relish tray. We had olives and radishes and celery and pickles and things like that. And then we had a sort of faux turkey alternative. that I actually loved when I was a kid. I can't imagine eating it now, but I loved it when I was a kid.
Well, I know one of the things that used to, anyway, it's probably a bit dated now, that got served up in the UK as the vegetarian alternative was a nut roast.
Oh.
It was some kind of meatloafy thing, I think. Well, obviously not meat because it didn't have any meat in it, but a sort of
right, but it was loafy. Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah. I've definitely had some of those. She didn't do that. She actually would buy a prepared loaf or roll from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because of course they had vegetarian, you know, options that they had all the time. They had their own little shop there. So she would get that and we would have that. And, you know, then all the accoutrement, even I think some sort of gravy probably to go with it, you know, meatless gravy. I, now that I think about it.
Interesting. So,
yeah. But she was a really good cook and she experimented a lot. And the funny thing is her dressing, she made really good dressing or stuffing. And it was back then she was doing like gluten free and whole grain. We didn't have any white flour or anything like that in the house. And maybe that was part of what made it so good, because she would just like collect all these unusual millet bread and things like that, you know. So it was definitely, ours was not traditional by any means, I can say that much.
It sounds like she made it tasty, even if now you're thinking, well, where's the good bit? But it sounds like, yeah, she really did make the most of what she did use.
She really did. She really was a really good cook and baker and loved to experiment and made a lot of things that really were, you know, really were delicious no matter what. She had obviously cooked traditionally before. She had grown up with, you know, on a farm, and she had cooked meat when she was younger. She, you know, like a lot of people in the 70s, she had, or late 60s, she had made some changes, and, you know, which in fairness, she had made some good changes. Again, like I said, she had cut out white sugar, she had cut out white flour, and preserve, you know, prepackaged, a lot of prepackaged foods and things like that. And she had had a positive effect on her health doing that. So it was a step in the right direction.
And is she someone who inspired you in your passion for cooking? Perhaps that's where the bug started biting to cook yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We lived with her growing up and she was in the kitchen a lot by necessity, but she also knew how to enjoy it and be creative. She was an artist also, and she approached everything sort of that way, I suppose. I can still remember she, you know, she had very expressive hands, and the way she would be working with them, whatever it was, whether she was drawing or, you know, sculpting or gardening or cooking, she helped to stoke a passion in me for food and seeing that you could be open to food and experiment with food. You know, when I was young, we lived in Detroit and she would take me to the local deli and, you know, we'd get sauerkraut and Greek olives and feta cheese. And I mean, I could just eat cold sauerkraut out of a paper boat, like at, you know, 3 years old. So I guess I was open to food back then, and, you know, she really encouraged that.
That's lovely. I think that my paternal grandmother actually probably influenced me a lot with cooking. She used to make some weird stuff. She used to get excited by cuisine from places she visited, like when she went to visit my father in Thailand. And came back full of, you know, stir fries and things.
Yeah.
Except that she often used to make her own twist. And I used to call her stir fry stew fry because she just cooked it forever. So it kind of sort of missed the whole point, really, but vaguely resembled the original dish. But she was doing things when I was younger, you know, things like making her own yogurt and things like that, which weren't the norm. Mm-hmm. She was often quite ahead of her time, and she had to get quite creative with food because Grampy had, I don't think he was actually celiac. I'm not sure he was ever tested, but he certainly had big problems with gluten. So she used to make all these different alternatives using things like, actually now, of course, and getting into keto cooking and baking, she was using a lot of things that we do, things like almond flour. And she used to use some things that we don't, like rice flour and things. She used to make the most amazing mince pies, which I think were a combination of maybe rice flour and almond flour, but I remember them being super crumbly and delicious.
Yeah.
But she used to cook everything from scratch and had a very traditional way they ate. They got up every day at six and had their breakfast, and then she would cook. They had their May meal at lunchtime, and then a more of a tea at dinner time, mm-hmm. a light meal. But whenever I stayed there, and I used to often go and stay there in the half-term holidays and things, and I was very much involved in the whole process, in the cooking process. And then there were lots of jokes with Grampy about eating. He used to love all the things that he couldn't have with the gluten intolerance. He loved his puddings, or desserts, as you call them. And when Granny used to ask if I wanted seconds, he used to look at me, no, you don't want seconds, because he would get whatever was left. So any seconds that I had, ate out of his seconds. But it was lovely. And my mother as well really has cooked things from scratch and has been very frugal with, you know, trying to eke out as much as you can from everything.
Yeah.
Making things from the leftovers of the roast chicken, say, you know, eking it out into pies or whatever later, and then making a stock from the bones.
Right.
It makes a difference, doesn't it? If you grow up surrounded by that, it really influences how you approach eating and cooking.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And one of the things that I love about this way of eating, of whether you want to call it, you know, if you're keto or low carb, high fat, or you're banting, whatever it may be, is that there is a return, you know, to an appreciation for those things. And so roasting meat on the bone means more than one meal. It means soup. It means stock. It means, you know, these very comforting and very sustaining things, you know. And oftentimes we get so caught up in what's right or what's wrong or what we should or what we shouldn't do, and we forget that there are people who are just asking themselves, will they eat today? And that's, you know, that generation of our grandparents, they lived through that, and therefore they had a very different feel about food and how to prepare it. And how, you know, my grandmother lived through the Depression and World War II, and she could, boy, oh boy, could that woman make anything last forever, you know, and make everything stretch. And, you know, her, that generation, my father's mother raised 12 kids. She and my grandfather, same thing, Depression, you know, out of, born in the segregated South, raised 12 children and, you know, knew how to, my dad always jokes about how my grandmother could feed 12 people with one can of tuna. You know?
So knew how to make things go a long way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It feels like just a respectful approach, I think, to treating food in that way. To take, so if someone gives you a chicken and you start with that, it feels to me respectful of that bird that you're eating in the first place.
Yes.
That was a living thing and is now on your plate.
Right.
It feels really disrespectful to me not to make the most of every part of it.
Yes.
To throw bits of it away when you could mm-hmm. be getting more meals out of it.
Yeah. And more nutrition. You know, that's the other thing, is we somehow take the most nutritious things for granted, or we refuse them. I don't want those bones. I don't want those internal organs. You know, I don't want to see that it was a living creature or whatever it may be. You know, a lot of people have gotten very disassociated from the food. And like I said, again, you know, I mean, what has sustained us and allowed us to survive and propagate is usually those things, bone marrow, you know, bone, cooking an animal so that there's enough for, you know, to serve, one animal can serve who knows how many people, you know, and maybe I'm a bit off track from holidays, but that's what I think it comes back to, because that is, again, that meaning of a feast is that perhaps there were some very lean days, and that feast is a real celebration of life and gratitude, and, you know, that we're being sustained or have that luxury of having something more than just the very, you know, little to get by, or having nothing. You know, and again, sometimes I see that people are very caught up in just what's important to them, you know, theoretically about food, and that's great. I mean, you should do what is best for you, but I hate to see it become so far removed from the reality that, you know, every day that you have food to eat is something you should be thankful for, because right now, amongst us and all over, are so many people who are not going to be eating today. You know, and I don't want to forget that. And I, you know, I've had lean times as myself as a single woman in New York City, that it was a question for me. Well, will I really be eating today? But still, I was surrounded by food. It wasn't a famine. I didn't have to really, really starve. So,
no, I think it is an important part of Christmas and festivities and times of celebration to remember and think about those people that don't have access to all of that. Because for every second that we're enjoying ourselves, there's someone who isn't.
Yeah. I think people experience this if they incorporate fasting into their keto or dietary experience, is that they also re-experience this true pleasure and joy of eating that many of us have forgotten or haven't experienced for a long time, because we're either forcing ourselves to eat or eating so often or eating food that we don't find pleasurable that has made us sick. That hunger is the best sauce. I believe it's Brillat Savarin who says that. And it's so true. You don't realize until you've experienced it. When you have been hungry for whatever reason, because you couldn't eat or because there wasn't anything, or just because you have had to go without food because you were on a long flight or you had surgery or whatever, that food, when you get to eat, when you haven't eaten, is so much more pleasurable and enjoyable and nourishing and satiating. And I think we also disconnect from that experience of the true joy of feeding ourselves and nourishing ourselves. And we miss that too. And, you know, it's all a part of life. It's all a part of our human experience that's really, really enriches our existence. And, you know, we should be allowed to connect to that. A holiday shouldn't just be an obligatory set of courses. Oh, I have to make this food or, you know, no. Whatever it is, whatever it may be, my grandmother used to just roast onions in the oven. That was one of her side dishes. They were so good. If it's a roast onion, enjoy it. So be it, you know, but enjoy it. For me, a roast onion is that experience of, you know, it was cold and she was baking and she was making the most of a humble ingredient, an inexpensive ingredient, but that it was a beautiful thing. It wasn't lacking in any way. And, you know, that when it comes to food, I can go on for a long time and I can say a lot of things, but I've had a lot of different experiences as a professional cook and in my life. And if I only communicate one thing, it's that food is amazing and it's this integral part of our humanity. It is us. It is what we are. It's what builds us. And a lot of us who have come from a background of whatever it may be, dieting, health problems, we have such a conflicted relationship with food, whether we should enjoy it or shouldn't enjoy it, what it means, or is it too much or too little? And we forget about just the simplicity of it, that we need it. You know, that it's, in a sense, our birthright. We need it. We deserve it. We have to have it. And we ought to be able to experience it in a healthy, joyful way, because that's natural. That's our most, you know, basic humanity, water, air, food. And we have a right to that. And that's what I mean to bring it back to topic, that I love the way that this lifestyle interacts with the holidays, that I can take a new look at them and approach them from a new angle. And I can stay keto. I can say, well, I remember those good times I had with sugar cookies or whatever, but to heck with it. This is, you know, I'm moving on and I'm going to have some new good times with some new things, and I'm going to have butter on that, and I'm going to, you know, really roast something beautiful and make a, you know, roasted side of Brussels sprouts or a vegetable puree. You know, we say collie mash here a lot, or cauliflower mash, but again, it's a return to a tradition. There have been vegetable purees for a very long time. You know, people have been making those without potatoes involved for a very long time. It's not something new. It's not something crazy. And that's good too. And now, instead of having to try to figure out how to make it delicious with nothing but vegetable broth, you can put in your butter and your cream or whatever, coconut cream, whatever it is you can have. Again, make your own traditions that you're happy with, that you're comfortable with, that you know, I think one of the things a lot of us love about this lifestyle is you can make something delicious and something ketogenic and take it to a potluck or take it to a family gathering. You don't even have to say a word. Oh, I loved that cheese ball. That was delicious. Whatever it may be.
It's not going to stand out as something crazy, is it?
No, everybody's probably going to attack it first, and you're going to wonder why you didn't make more, because now you don't have anything.
You haven't got anything to eat, because everyone has eaten yours. Yeah. No, I think it's really lovely to have that mouth-watering anticipation again about food.
Yeah.
And you're right that if you do experiment at all with fasting, that really comes back. Even fasting for 24 hours, fasting just by skipping breakfast and just having a longer time before your next meal really just has that mouth-watering sensation that you have thinking about what you're going to have.
Yes.
It's fantastic. And having the added flavor that comes into that of associating it with the favorite things that your grandmother used to do just really adds to the sensations and the flavors and the taste of that food and the whole experience of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. My family at this point, you know, my immediate family is my husband and I. We spend our holidays together, our working days together. So I don't do big meals for us. You know, that would be a bit much, especially since I cook all day, every day anyway. But we, at this point, have our own, you know, little traditions that we do. So neither one of us are big chicken eaters. It's not our favorite, but I do like to occasionally roast a whole chicken. And that's good for us. We don't need a turkey or something larger. And I love to roast a chicken simply, but with a lot of flavor. And again, so that I can make a pan sauce and have, you know, have these added side dishes or whatever. But it's very simple. And I just, you need like about a 3 pound chicken, 3.5 pound chicken. That's about it, you know. And three things that I like to do that, you know, make it a little different. I used to do this with my students all the time. It comes out really well. One is that I put fresh herbs inside the chicken in the body cavity. I use sage, rosemary, thyme, and parsley. And then you season the inside of it really well. That body cavity is a bit of a barrier, so it's almost impossible to over-season by seasoning inside the chicken.
Right, so it just kind of steams and filtrates out through the meat and flavors it, I guess. Yeah.
Yes. And then I truss it just so it holds its shape and it cooks more evenly with a little bit of butcher string. And then roast it over a bed of mirepoix, which is a combination of celery, carrots, and onions. And you can also do white mirepoix, which is celery, parsnip, and onions, and it often includes leek. And the ratio for a mirepoix is 50% onion to 25% celery to 25% carrot or parsnip, if that would be what you're using. And I use that as a bed under the chicken. So it does two things. It helps to flavor it and keep it moist, and then it also collects the drippings and doesn't allow them to scorch in the pan. And I actually, you know, you're supposed to put a roasting rack over the mirepoix, but I actually just like to put the chicken right on the mirepoix. I just cut it really chunky, and then I just put the chicken on top of it. And then for the first about hour of the cooking, you cook the chicken upside down, breast side
down. I was going to ask you about that. That's a trick I read about quite a while ago to try and keep the breast meat, which has a tendency to get dry, keep
to
it
dry
moist.
Out, yeah.
Yeah. And it works.
And
it really
works. It really works. And also that those aromatics that are in that body cavity, they get into the breast meat because they're above it. So it's dripping down into there. Then after that first 40 minutes to an hour, you turn it over and, you know, allow it to finish cooking. And you may have to cover it for a while, but when you uncover it, the skin still crisps up, even though it's been underneath for all that time. And you get a very juicy, flavorful, moist, you know, really beautiful chicken. And then, the other thing I do is I start it out for first 15 minutes is at a higher temperature, about 450, and then take it down to like 325 for the rest of the cooking. The whole cooking time is about 2.5 hours. What you have in the pan, of course, is this also amazing, unctuous, flavorful pan drippings that you can make a very simple pan sauce. The vegetables, if you haven't, you know, if they haven't scorched, hopefully they haven't, because you need enough in the pan not to scorch. Just cover the whole bottom. I use a small saute pan so that it's just barely bigger than the chicken. And there's not a lot of room in every, you know, it helps to collect all the juices together. You just pull out those vegetables and, you know, you can even puree them and add them to the sauce, or, you know, puree them and have them as a side dish if you wish, or you can just use them to flavor the sauce and discard them. you're going to have all this beautiful fat and pan drippings, the fond in the bottom of the pan that you can deglaze with a little bit of chicken broth or a little bit of wine or even water. And you don't need a lot. You can strain off some of the fat if there's a very lot of fat there. You season it. And again, you've had these herbs and these vegetables roasting in there. The flavor is phenomenal, but there's nothing in there. You know, it's true flavor. There's not a packet of, you know, gravy mix. There's not a, some starchy component. It's just the true essence of those foods and the chicken and the flavor. You heat it through, and then at the end, you can just add a knob of butter, of, you know, cool butter, and whisk it in, mounting it with butter. And that chicken and that sauce is very often all we eat. We don't even have a side dish or anything. It's so good. It's so delicious. Satisfying.
Yeah.
And I have learned, I used to probably have bread or something with that rice. I've learned that the chicken, the white chicken meat, I finally understood what it's good for. It absorbs the sauce.
I was going to say, that's a good thing to
mop it up. You wipe up your sauce with that, you know, even if it's a little dry, it's okay because you're going to wipe up that pan sauce with it, that glorious pan sauce. And again, you know, if you're a little hungry, you know, I don't know if you fast or not. I'm not advocating for anything, but if you have a good appetite going, you know, you'll be on cloud nine.
You're going to be drooling with the smell of that cookie in the oven. Now, I mean, I've always made, and this comes from my mother watching her making gravy from roasting whatever meat you've roasted. And then you take those pan juices and you mix it. Usually what she used to use, and I've always done the same, is using the water from the vegetables and that you've cooked as the side dishes.
Right.
And what I used to do actually was to start with the first thing that you'd cook at that time. I used to have my roast potatoes, but cook the potatoes in the water, and then you drain off the potatoes when you put those in to roast with the meat, and you keep that water and you cook the next thing. So I don't know, maybe it was some carrots, and you cook the carrots in it, keep the water, cook the cabbage in it. So by the end, you get this quite reduced down vegetable stock, which then again adds the flavor in with the meat juices and makes the most fantastic gravy.
Yeah, absolutely.
We were talking about what's going to happen on Christmas Day with the cooking this year, actually. And we both agreed that we'll basically hand it over to my brother. He'll be in charge. He's quite bossy and he likes things done the way he likes. So I said, I'll just be sous chef. I'll just do what I'm told. But I said, no, the one thing that nobody can match is your gravy. So she'll be making the gravy, and that with the turkey. Turkey, certainly in the UK, usually come with the giblets inside, and you take those out and they get boiled down, and that gets added to the pan juices and makes the most incredible tasting gravy. Delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I forgot the giblets, which sometimes here, it's funny, you get them sometimes and sometimes you don't. It really depends on who packages the bird. If you have giblets, by all means, you know, you want to use those to make your gravy. And what you were saying about the vegetables, you know, reminded me, speaking of being frugal and using things, here in the States, once upon a time, people used to keep what they called pot liquor. And that was the cooking water from their vegetables. And, you know, they kept it and added it to soups or sauces or for cooking more vegetables or for whatever it was. And it was flavorful. And it was, and again, that idea of preserving every bit of nutrition. And of course, water. Water was also, you know, harder, much harder to come by.
And you can make a vegetable stock, can't you, by keeping all the vegetable trimmings that you have and maybe, you know, throwing them in a bag in the freezer or something until, you know, do that with bones as well, actually. If you've had something that you don't have enough bones left over to make a stock, you can just keep a bag in the freezer, can't you, until you've got a nice collection, and then put them all in a pan and make some incredible stock. Homemade stock, broth. There's no comparison, is there, to the kind of shop-bought stuff that you can buy?
No. I mean, not only in regards of taste and that you can please yourself, you know, you can make it however you'd like. And then, of course, the fact that it's just 9 times out of 10, there's some sort of additive in prepared broth stock. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. You know, I mean, it's very easy for stock to go off. It's very easy for broth to go off. It has to be shelf stable. They have to have something in there. And those things aren't necessarily things you want in your finished product. So when you make your own at home, whatever it may be, it's going to be a better quality, and it's going to suit your needs. I can't really buy prepackaged beef broth or stock anyway, because it usually has tomatoes in it. So, I can't really have tomatoes. I have to make my own, you know, that sort of thing. Because once you start reading labels, of course, it's a whole new world.
Exactly. If there's anything you react to, homemade is always better. So what else do you tend to have with your chicken? I know you said that quite often you just eat your chicken, but are there any favorite sort of little side dishes that you tend to cook up?
Well, I'll make sautéed mushrooms to go with almost anything. I love mushrooms, any kind of mushrooms. I don't care what kind they are.
They're great sponges, aren't they, for
yeah,
flavor and fat and sauces.
Sometimes when I want something to mop up some sauce or some juice, I'll do that. And then, of course, I also make, I do make cauliflower puree. And I actually like making it a lot. And, it's funny. It's funny to say, but in a way, I almost like it better than potatoes at this point, because it's so much easier to work with. So there's no worrying about making it gummy or soggy, or, you know, in the same way that you would have to with potatoes. But I do use the same techniques that I used to use for making potato puree, and that works well for me. I've seen a lot of people say that, you know, it didn't come out the way they like, or it didn't come out creamy, or it didn't come out, and, you know, it's not potatoes. It will be different. But I actually have whatever you want to call it, a hack, a cheat, a shortcut. I don't know.
Oh, tell me, because funnily enough, actually, I made cauliflower puree, mash, whatever you like to call it, yesterday. So I'm intrigued to hear your method.
Well, the first thing, maybe somebody's going to get upset with me, but I use frozen cauliflower, and with no compunctions, zero compunctions. The goal of my making the puree is to soften the vegetable and allow it to break down to a point that it's, creamy. So a frozen cauliflower is perfect for that, because when we freeze a vegetable, what happens? The cell walls burst and then they break down. Half the work is done. So if I want a nice, you know, al dente vegetable, it's going to be a disaster. If I want something soft, somebody has already done half the work for me. It's usually less expensive. And if I bring home, or if I bring to the restaurant, a vegetable that I don't cook with daily, it may go to waste because I won't have time to get to it. If I have a frozen bag of cauliflower in the freezer, it's there for me when I need it. And then I just do what I have to do. Again, I would not apologize to anybody for that. So I just steam them with as little water as possible. And beauty is, they're frozen, so they already have quite a bit of water in there. And I actually just do it in a saute pan. I just throw them in a saute pan with like a drop of water, bring it up to a boil, cover it, and just let them cook on their own. Once it's fully cooked, which doesn't take that long because they're frozen, but I still, you know, I let them cook for probably about maybe 10 minutes. And then I drain off the water, whatever water is there, and then I put them back in that dry pan and cook off as much water as possible. And you don't need oil or anything. There's so much water in those vegetables that unless you have it just going at some crazy, crazy high heat and you leave the room, you can see what they're doing. And they don't have starch like a potato, so they're not going to stick. So I just drive off as much of that water as I possibly can in that dry pan. And then I may add a little cream to that in the heat, or I may not. And that's, again, this is the other beauty thing of it. You can just put it in the food processor. You don't have to worry. It's not going to get gummy. I just put them in the food processor without too much added at first. The food processor needs to be able to get a hold. The blade has to get a hold of the cauliflower. So I just put it in there and start it up. Like I said, there may be a little bit of cream that I've warmed in the pan with it, maybe a couple tablespoons or something. And then I puree it. You know, I blitz it. It's all it can't be blitzed anymore. And then I add in whatever I would like right into the food processor. Cream, some sort of soft cheese. I've done it with goat cheese. I've done it with cream cheese, obviously. And whatever flavorings, sometimes I put fresh herbs. I use a salt seasoning called Herbamar, which is just sea salt with herbs. It works really well for like neutral, mild flavors like that. I like it with eggs. I like it with vegetables. And it's fine. It looks nice. And sometimes if I want it to stay white looking, I'll add white pepper instead of black pepper. But white pepper's very strong. You only need a little bit.
I've got some truffle salt, actually. When you were talking about that flavored salt,
yeah.
I thought, that would be nice in there, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the beauty of it. You know, it's a blank slate. There's a little flavor there, of course, but, you know, you can do whatever you'd like with it.
Yeah, so it kind of depends what you're serving it with, really. So you can, you know, you can add flavors depending on that.
Yeah, or omit them if you want it to be really, you know, mild and just support the flavor of something else. That's okay, too. Then, oftentimes I will add, I don't always, but I will add maybe just a tablespoon of some sort of dry cheese, a grated Parm or a grated Romano, something like that, because that will help to absorb more moisture and hold it together, but you don't have to. Once that's done, this was just a necessity, another thing that just came out of necessity. I'd be in the restaurant, I would decide when I had free time, to make the puree. And then I would reheat it when we wanted it. But what happened with that is, so I would put it in, just like a tin tray, but any baking dish is fine, and I would set it to the side. Then when I wanted to eat it, I would put it back in the oven for a while. And I usually drizzle a little olive oil over the top or put a couple of pats of butter on top. So what happens is that second cooking, again, begins to remove more moisture. By that time, it has a chance to set up. And it has a much more pleasing texture. It's more creamy and more spoon, you know, you can sort of spoon a dollop of it as opposed to it being runny. And so I think a lot of times that's what happens. Either people have far too much liquid in it, and so it's not coming together as a puree, or they have not cooked the vegetable enough, especially if they started from raw. So of course you can never get it creamy because it still has that crunch and or that grittiness to it. You know, we've been trained that al dente vegetables are good, and they are. I mean, I don't want to eat mushy cauliflower if I'm eating cauliflower. But when you're going to use it in a different way, you can't be afraid to prepare it in a different way because you need to know what you want it to do. You know, I used to tell my students, like, listen, you can't make everything go your way. You can't make people do what you want them to do. But when it comes time to cook and it's you and it's your food and you're at your stove, this is the one time that you get to be dominate. You get to tell the onion what it's going to do. You get to tell the chicken what it's going to do. You get to bring, you know, yourself full bear to this. And sometimes people are afraid of that. For some reason, they feel like the vegetable has the power in this situation. You know, I'm not sure why, but, you know, and they're intimidated. No, it's, you know, go for it. The worst thing can happen is you could make a mistake, but that's okay. Mistakes lead to other good dishes. You'll do something else with it. That's how we learn. But you're going to be in charge. You're going to tell the cauliflower what it's going to do today, and that's perfectly acceptable.
It's a tricky one, cauliflower, I think. And yeah, I've been put off because I think probably the first time I made it, I boiled it and there was too much water in there. And I ended up, when I blitzed it in the food processor, with a wet wallpaper mush that was disgusting.
Yeah.
So I was really put off making it. The way I made it yesterday, actually, was to roast the cauliflower in the oven. So I had it in a tray. And so this is from Fresh.
Yeah.
I had it in a tray and I covered it with foil. So it was steamed, but I'd put no water in there. I'd washed the cauliflower, so I guess there was a tiny bit. And it steamed for a while. And then I took the foil off to dry it out a bit and then put it in the food processor. But I tell you what I think I was afraid of from my previous experience was over mixing it. And so ended up with it tasted fine, but it was much coarser.
Yeah.
And probably had a slight bite to it. But I think I was afraid of overdoing it because I thought maybe I was going to end up with this mush that I'd had before. And I think a lot of people seem to struggle with it. So I'm definitely going to try your method because that sounds really probably the easiest way. And most foolproof to get something that tastes good.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. You mess around with these things and you make something and you spend time making it and you end up with something that's disgusting. And you're sort of, I'm never making that again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, I guess, the privilege of being someone who cooks all the time. I know that sometimes things are going to go awry, and of course I've spent that time making my mistakes too, but I still have some brilliant idea and try it. And I'm like, wow, was that a disaster? You know, but luckily that's one disaster in life that I can perceive as, you know, okay, I learned something. Of course, I don't want that to happen when somebody's waiting for their meal, but, you know, on my own, I could make that decision. And the puree of most vegetables, as long as there's not a lot of water in there, I mean, you can puree it forever. It's fine. You know, just like making soup in a Vitamix blender, you can puree it till you have soup. It'll be fine because it doesn't have a starch or, you know, a gluten that's going to react in a bad, adverse way to that. You just have to get the water out. And, you know, I love roasted cauliflower. I don't know how many people who told me they wouldn't eat cauliflower, they didn't like cauliflower. You know, I know this young woman who literally, she had a fight with her sister about the cauliflower once it's roasted. I think it's amazing. It tastes like candy.
And it soaks up flavors as well, doesn't it? I like putting, you know, Indian type spices and olive oil and things.
It's amazing. I always feel like I'm really eating like some kind of, I mean, even before I went keto, I always felt like I was like eating some sort of luxury, you know, candy, like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't even be eating this. I don't know. But if I were to roast cauliflower, it would never make it to the food processor. It would be gone. It would never get in there. My husband and I would just be fighting each other and, you know, there'd be like one piece left. So I will continue to steam it for, for my puree. When I roast it, I will just eat it roasted because I know myself better than that.
It's a great tip, though, using the frozen cauliflower, because it's certainly the kind of thing that I've avoided like the plague, because, like you say, normally you would be trying to turn those frozen florets into something that you're used to having as cooking from fresh, so having that bite to it. And so you've been put off from using it for years because it's just mushy.
Yeah.
But of course, when you want it to be mushy, it's perfect.
Why not give yourself a head start?
For sure. I'm going to be trying that. And like you say, it's cheaper as well.
Oh, yeah. And of course, if you don't feel like spending some time chopping vegetables, and, you know, some people don't wish to, and some people really genuinely don't have time to, you know, hey, frozen vegetables have sort of the same bad rap as, you know, canned vegetables. But depending on how they've been prepared and where they've come from, they often have more nutrients than the fresh vegetables because they're usually processed on site or near where they've been harvested. I mean, I'm speaking of, you know, American processing, of course. I don't know about anywhere else. So oftentimes they actually are more nutritious and, in an odd sense, almost fresher.
Yes, because they've been frozen, haven't they, very soon after harvesting. So instead of like something like a fresh cauliflower can hang around for weeks, if not months, before it ends up in your shopping basket.
Yeah. And you don't realize that a lot of produce sits in storage somewhere until it's needed, until it's called upon, you know. So not to knock fresh vegetables, don't get me wrong, I'm all for them. They're great. But like I said, I think as long as your frozen vegetables don't have anything added to them, and that's the other beauty of it. To freeze a vegetable, you don't have to add anything. You don't have to put a preservative. You don't have to worry about that. So, you know, if they're good quality, I don't think you have anything to worry about. And you know, the other aspect of that is, again, I think we often don't address people who don't have a lot of money to spend on food. They deserve a good meal. They deserve nutritious food. And, you know, if it works for you to buy frozen, especially when they're on special, if your local store has a special on something, and you can afford to do so, or you have the room to do so, stock up. Bring home 5, 6, 10 bags of that frozen cauliflower when it's at a good deal, and then use it as you need it.
Could you also cook it? This is another thing I've read, which I don't know if it's true or not, but cooking vegetables in the microwave can keep more of the nutrition inside because they just cook in their own juices. You don't add water to them. I was wondering if you could go straight from the frozen cauliflower and get it to soft in the microwave. Would that work or not?
Yeah, you certainly could. I have a funny glitch that I don't have a microwave, so I often just forget that people have them. So I'm a little weird when it comes to that. Yeah, you know, I mean, you could absolutely put that frozen cauliflower probably directly in the microwave without any added liquid, as long as it's covered, I would imagine. And, you know, same thing, just let it blast until it's ready to go. And the only thing is that extra step of removing the moisture, you would drain it out if there was anything left in there. And I don't know exactly how you would handle that. You might have to lay it out on a paper towel or something.
Well, it's one thing actually that I found, I have occasionally cooked cauliflower in the microwave, is to get it that little bit drier, is that you don't cover it. Or so you could cover it to start with so that it had the steam, but then you finish off the cooking, like you were saying, you finish off the cooking when you're cooking it in the pan with it uncovered.
Yeah.
You cook it in the microwave uncovered, and a lot of that steam goes away.
That makes sense.
I'll experiment and I'll get back to you with the results.
Yeah.
Now, I know you mentioned earlier to me before we were discussing this that you might have a recipe that the Brits are going to love. Now, there's something that traditionally goes with beef, but often gets served up with the Christmas dinner, and that's Yorkshire puddings. And I gather That's you right. might have. You might have keto-fied it. So I'm dying to hear about this.
Well, this is funny because this is like I was saying, you know, sometimes the best laid plans, you know, like I was trying to actually make a keto-fied clafouti and it went okay. But when it came out of the oven, I was like, wow, this really looks like Yorkshire pudding in the places where I didn't have any raspberries. So I don't have an exact recipe because I was making something different. But what I did, I looked at it and realized it would work seemingly perfectly for Yorkshire pudding. And I was going to try to test it, but I haven't had time. So instead of putting flour in, I just used a combination of plain, unflavored protein powder. And I think egg protein would work the best. Egg white protein, but also you could use plain whey protein. And I used just like a half a teaspoon of xanthan gum just to give it a little body to go with, because sometimes the protein powder, you know, it doesn't have much body to it. And instead of milk, I used cream and then the eggs. So I'm trying to think what's the usual ratio, but, you know, maybe if you would use like, say, 3/4 of a cup of flour, you probably would use really like about 1/2 cup of protein powder, and then that 1/2 teaspoon to 1 teaspoon of xanthan gum. You don't need much. A little bit goes a long way. I would say start with 1/2 teaspoon. And maybe 3 eggs somewhere in there. Everybody has their own opinion about how many eggs and how much, you know, so I don't even want to start that. But and of course, it's not my specialty. It worked beautifully, and obviously in hot fat. So what I had was a cast iron skillet with butter in it for the clafouti, and it puffed up all around and made this beautiful crown and had a crisp edge and was full of steam, just like, I mean, it basically, I had basically made Yorkshire pudding. I could be honest about that. But there's also not a big difference at the end of the day between those two things. You know, everybody seems to have some sort of egg-based pancake, you know, sort of baked good. And a little salt, obviously. So if you have beautiful beef drippings, beef fat drippings, and a nice hot oven going already and heat up the pan, I don't see why you shouldn't have a beautiful Yorkshire pudding.
That would be a great way to add flavor, actually, wouldn't it? Because quite often in the UK, they make them little individual ones in like muffin tins, I suppose they would be. And you put it in the oven and get it really hot. And you could use, if you use beef dripping or tallow as the fat in there.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
It comes out smoking hot. And that's the trick, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is to have that oil smoking hot and then you pour your mix in. So it starts puffing straight away. And then, of course, it goes straight back in the oven and it carries
right.
on.
Right.
Well, I'm going to be trying. I'm going to be trying this recipe.
Yeah.
We'll work out what the actual, you know, the ratios are. We'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be trying that because it's one of the things that I really miss. So it would be fabulous to have an alternative. Yeah. I mean, and of course, it's a great thing, again, to mop up gravy.
Yeah.
It's the little Yorkshire pudding that has the well that you pour the gravy in. And they quite often it's a meal that's often served up in pubs where they make big sort of almost plate size Yorkshire puddings.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
it has all the meat and vegetables inside and then all the gravy poured on and it's quite delicious. So I'm definitely up for taste testing that
one. Yeah, right. And of course that beautiful traditional use of the fat, you know, the fat that would be dripping from the roast anyway. Don't waste it, right?
Absolutely. And it's going to add such great flavor.
Yeah. Definitely.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you today. There's a few recipes in there and all sorts of chat about all our different traditions that we know about. And obviously, there are so many more that we haven't mentioned. But maybe next year.
Maybe.
Everyone
next year,
write in
right.
and tell us your traditions and we'll talk about them next year.
Yeah, that would be lovely.
So what would be your special Christmas top tip?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was really thinking about it and I was thinking about what I really remember about the holidays, you know, and what sticks home to me. And I think for me, what it really came down to is to, you know, we get caught up in, is it going to be perfect? And, you know, how's the dishes, how's the meals going to look and so forth? And are we going to get along with our, you know, brother-in-law or whatever? And you know what? It doesn't have to be perfect. And you can put aside your ideas of, you know, the Hallmark perfect holiday. And when you do, you can enjoy what really matters. And I think if you ask yourself, what will you remember? What will be your fond memories or your children's fond memories, your grandchildren's fond memories in 20 years? You know, it may be a conversation or, you know, we used to play old records, the Christmas records on a record player, play pickup sticks or these, you know, games that my grandmother had when she was young, and try to invest your time and energy into those things and, you know, allow yourself to enjoy them. You know, there will be people that won't always be there with you, and enjoy those moments and don't stress yourself about all those details, which you will not remember by next year.
That's very true. That's, yeah, that's lovely. It doesn't have to be perfect, and really enjoying the moment. And we often get away from this, don't we, with people always wanting to take pictures or videos with their phones.
Yeah.
You know, put them down and just really experience the moment and the time you have with people who are really special.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if it's someone in your family you don't get along with, and they're, you know, they're curmudgeonly and they get on your nerves, there'll be a day when you will laugh about that person and say, oh, they were terrible. But Christmas just isn't the same without them.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you have a lovely Christmas. I know you're very, very busy, especially the run-up. Christmas Day itself might be a bit of a rest for you, but really this is a super busy time for you. So I'm really grateful for you taking the time out to talk to me today. And I wish you the loveliest of Christmas and happy holidays.
Thank you. And much the same to you. And I really enjoyed this time and I really appreciate coming back. Thank you.
And we'll have you back soon in the new year when you've got a little bit more time on your hands.
Amen to that. Thanks, Stacey. Be well.
And you. To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowomen. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is the same one from the original episode and is from Virginia Woolf. One cannot think well, love well, sleep well if one has not dined well. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.